This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bradley Morgan, and I am joined today by my guest, Aaron Cohen. Aaron covers the arts for numerous publications and teaches English, journalism, and humanities at City Colleges of Chicago, and is also the author of Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace, an installment of Bloomsbury Publishing's 33 and a Third music book series. Aaron's latest book is Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power, and is published by the University of Chicago Press. Aaron, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
For listeners who may have yet to read your book, share with us what it's about.
Well, what I do in this book is I look at the social, cultural, and musical changes that shaped rhythm and blues or soul music in Chicago, specifically from a period from about 1957 to about 1983. And then I also look at how the musicians themselves in the city became agents, not just of musical change, but also of social and political changes as well. And I spoke to more than 100 musicians, activists, entrepreneurs, producers, and discuss how all of this happened and what also made it so influential worldwide and what made the music in Chicago stand out as music, along with being part of this larger movement.
So why specifically Chicago?
I grew up in Evanston, not far from Chicago. I spent pretty much my entire life here in Chicago, and I've always loved the music from Chicago. One of the things that I've also loved is reading about rhythm and blues music, soul music. Growing up, I read books like Peter Guralnick's Sweet Soul Music, which looked at the way soul music, primarily in the South, intersected with larger political and social themes. A few years ago, there were books by like Dancing in the Street by the scholar Suzanne Smith, which looked at similar political social changes in Detroit and how that was responding, how music in Detroit, soul music, was responding to these changes. And I felt that it was very necessary for such a book to be about Chicago, Chicago rhythm and blues, because the music is so incredibly great. And there is so much in the way that musicians and Chicagoans were so much a part of such movements as the civil rights movement, the post-civil rights movement, the rise of African-American urban politicians, such cultural forces as Soul Train, as the rise of African-American advertising industry. A lot of that was so seeped in Chicago, so connected to Chicago, that I wanted to explore that as well. Another thing that I've been doing over these years is I've been writing about jazz. I was an editor at the jazz magazine Downbeat, and I wanted to discuss how much jazz and rhythm and blues in Chicago had intersected. So those were my reasons for writing the book, and also just a great love I have for the people who made the music. And I was such, it was such an honor and privilege and joy to speak to so many of them. And that was another reason for writing the book.
You mentioned that the period you cover is from the late 1950s to the early 1980s, and you don't move beyond that because those decades and the aesthetic and stylistic and musical choices necessitate or would necessitate their own books. But set the scene for us. What was going on in Chicago during this time, and how did the culture of soul and R&B fit into it?
Sure. Well, I started the book with the image of the Impressions, Curtis Mayfield, Jerry Butler, their group, as they were teenagers, along with their manager, Eddie Thomas, walking down Record Row in the late 1950s. I thought that would be a great place to start. And then, of course, they grew up in the Cabrini-Green housing projects, but a lot of their contemporaries grew up in the Chicago South and West Sides during segregation. And segregation is still very much a part of Chicago, but things were changing. This was a few years later. Dr. King would come to Chicago. Well, about 9 years later, Dr. King would come to Chicago. There was the rise of the civil rights movement, the rise of Afrocentric philosophy, which I talk about in the book and how that intersected with music. There was also, and then I end the book in 1983 with the ascent of Harold Washington to become the first African-American mayor of Chicago. And musicians were very much a part of the Harold Washington campaign. And then there were also musical changes that happened afterwards too, such as house music, and which wound up having its own book. There's a book by another scholar, Mika Salkin, about house music, but it had to end somewhere. So the late 1950s, with what was happening, seemed like a good place to start. All of the great music that was created in the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s, and then I had to end it there. And also, it just seemed like that was a good beginning, middle, end narrative.
Absolutely. And when you consider all of the musical histories of cities like Memphis and Detroit that were covered very extensively, it's crazy to think that there was this scholarly hole, you know, when it comes to Chicago soul music. And this book does an amazing job of that. And one of the most remarkable qualities of this book is the deep level of research that went into it. You mentioned you did over 100 interviews. How were you able to gain access to so many people, and what was that process of interviewing them like?
Well, let me also backtrack and say there had been some very good books about soul music in Chicago. I want to mention Robert Pruder's book, Chicago Soul, as an example, and that came out in the early 1990s. So there had been some, but I felt there should be more. I know we're on audio, not video. If we were in video, you could see the big stacks and racks of books I have along with my records. And again, a lot of books about Memphis, Southern Soul, a lot of books on Detroit, but I felt there could be more about Chicago. And there still can be more about Chicago, still more that can be said. In terms of access to musicians, some of them I interviewed for articles from writing for publications like the Chicago Tribune, for Downbeat. That provided access to some musicians. There were others who I contacted on social media. There were others who I would approach when I would see them at concerts and events. And then there was also word of mouth. I would meet somebody and somebody would put me in touch with somebody else. And somebody would also, and most, I'd say just about everybody who I wanted to approach to speak was agreeable. And that was just wonderful. And again, I was so privileged, so honored, so much in their debt. And there was a couple interesting things too. I guess I could talk about one instance. One of the primary, most important people in my book is Jerry Butler. and Jerry Butler, as I mentioned, singer in The Impressions. He also, brilliant, wonderful singer. He also ran a songwriter's workshop in the late 60s. And that was something else I wanted to write about, was this collectiveness and this idea of musicians working as a cooperative. And he was very much a part of that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there were political changes as well. And Jerry Butler became an elected official, Cook County Board for many, many years. And I'd interviewed him briefly for the Tribune, but I wanted to interview him in more depth for this book, and left messages and never heard back. A friend of mine who I grew up with, Matt DeLeon, a friend of mine from junior high school, that's how far back these things go, a friend of mine from junior high school, who at the time was the attorney for the Cook County Board. And he told me, hey, Aaron, you know, you're doing this book. You really need to talk to Jerry Butler. And you need to talk to him soon because he's going to be retiring very soon. And I said, oh, I'd love to, but haven't heard back. And Matt said, I'm meeting with him right now about some Cook County Board business. I'll mention that to him. And an hour later, Matt emailed me and said, call this number. And it was Commissioner Jerry Butler's cell phone number. And it was a wonderful interview. He was wonderful. The one regret is that he had so many funny things to say, which, you know, were in the context of me asking him questions and his funny responses, which I couldn't really include in the text because it didn't really flow right, but they're in the footnotes. A lot of my footnotes are footnotes like you would have where I reference my sources and everything, but some are little jokes and asides. So there's a couple of Jerry Butler witticisms in there as well. So there are many different ways in which I was interviewing people. And there were so many more I could have interviewed because there was just so many of these wonderful musicians. And I'm still meeting great people who were part of that scene from the 60s and 70s who, you know, I will still have very important stories to tell. So there are so many.
So a lot of these interviews, you're talking with people who were recalling events from 50 to 60 years ago, and memories fade, or they might have some kind of bias or axe to grind or something. You know, the facts can fluctuate over time. So how did you verify these stories? What was your journalistic process for that?
Well, some of what they said could be documented. Some of it, for instance, you know, instances and what recording sessions people appeared on. And yes, like you say, there are some instances of people with axes to grind, people with personal issues. I think for me, what was important in these stories were primarily what they showed about what this person was experiencing and how they shaped somebody's perspective. And for instance, there were some stories that were told to me by the late Syl Johnson, and I can't verify their veracity. And I explain in the text that I hope the story is true because it's such a wonderful story, and you'll have to read the book to see what I'm talking about. But I said right away, I can't vouch for the accuracy, the veracity of this story, but it indicates what his mindset was. It indicates how he felt about this particular time, place, and situation, and whether or not his actions were as they say, they reverberate through the recording that he made at this time. And this was the Is It Because I'm Black album, which was his statement about civil rights after Dr. King's assassination. And so what it shows about Syl Johnson tells me more than things that were truthful. Now, there were a lot of people with axes to grind. There were people who have grudges, things like that. I didn't want to put in anything that was hurtful. That was also just not part of the narrative. I mean, why? You know, there's really no purpose. But it was also the funny thing too is there's a kind of an opposite, thing about that is that there were certain people who were in the book who people just had the most wonderful, nice things to say about. For instance, the late Donny Hathaway, as a singer, songwriter, producer, arranger, everybody just said the most beautiful, wonderful, glowing things about him. And so again, they're probably true, and I certainly hope they're true. I have no reason to feel otherwise. And they're just, again, indicative of how people feel about Donny Hathaway. Clarence Ludd, the club owner who ran the late Clarence Ludd, who ran the High Chaparral Club in the 1970s. Everybody had great things to say about him. And this is a club owner. Musicians in general do not have nice things to say about club owners for all the reasons that, no, they don't, for all the reasons that we understand. But he was one who everybody had the most glowing things to say about him. And when I would look up articles about him in publications like The Defender or back issues of Ebony and Jet, they would report on some of the things that he did that were very altruistic. So it did corroborate what people were saying. There's some interesting things too, in that sometimes people would tell me things that certainly were contrasted with the historical record. And I would put those in there because that was their perspective. For instance, in writing about high schools, like West Side High Schools. And there were scholarly articles by scholars talking about the deprivation in these schools. But then when I would talk to people who attended these schools, like the songwriter, Raynard Minor, who wrote the hit Rescue Me, and he just had glowing things to say about the school. Now, who's right, him or the historian? Well, I feel these perspectives should be put out there. And and of course, with when you're a journalist, when you're a historian, you go through the evidence and then you put your own conclusion as a journalist or as a historian. But I felt that these perspectives were of equal weight, and I felt they should all be put out there.
One of the things that really strikes me with this book is again, all the stories from all the interviews. That's really impressive in its own right. But it's also the focus on Black cultural and social power. And there's a lot of joy that emanates from these stories and emanates from those experiences. And that's something you don't really, see as much with, in terms of the Black experience. It's either through overcoming adversity or struggling, but there's a lot of joy here. And we talked about a lot of the earlier publications that focus on Chicago music, and you felt like there should be more. What was that element? What element was missing?
One of the things, there were a few things, and one of them was that how the, for instance, Afro Arts Theater, which was the theater run by Phil Caron, who brought in Afrocentric thought, Afrocentric beliefs, there's been, he'd been written about in books about jazz, but I felt that his role in soul music needed to be explored deeper because he had a big influence on people like Chaka Khan and people like Maurice White, who founded Earth, Wind, and Fire. And so I really felt that that needed to be put in an R&B context. It had been written about in the jazz context, like in George Lewis's book on the AACM, Power Stronger Than Itself. But I felt that, again, going about how the jazz and R&B needed to be more intertwined. But also, too, I think that the role of musicians in elected politics and the different routes that people took, musicians took to empower themselves. I mentioned Jerry Butler. He was one who went through the elected role of an elected official. Phil Caron, who I just mentioned, was an influence on people like Chaka Khan and Maurice White, who wanted to empower themselves through Afrocentric thought, spirituality, philosophy. There were musicians like Chaka Khan and Tyrone Davis who spoke about their admiration for Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers. So there was that more militant pathway as well. There were musicians like, of course, Curtis Mayfield, who sought empowerment through entrepreneurialism, running Kurtom Records, running his business along with his partner, Eddie Thomas. There were ones like Carl Davis, who went up through the ranks of the corporate model of Brunswick Records, his own company, Dakar Records. So he had the corporate means of empowerment. And he, alongside the rise of Operation Push and the Push Expo, was part of this corporate model of empowerment. But then on another whole entire level is the empowerment of people to say, this music is ours, meaning that we can do what we want with our music. There were people like the composer and arranger Charles Stepney, who felt that these avant-garde classical ideas belong as part of soul music. Teachers and people like James Mack, who was a teacher and arranger and composer, who felt that for African-American youths, the so-called European classical tradition is theirs as well, and their music should reflect that. There were also people like the singers, like Jackie Ross and Mitty Collier, who, you know, refused to be pushed around by label people in Chicago. So many different paths. And then, too, the diversity in Chicago music echoed the diversity in approaches to empowerment.
As you write in the book, you were seeking to detail, and this is your quote, how mass movements and localized efforts for dynamic change helped create R&B in Chicago, and that musicians acted as change agents. Chicago was one of many cities going through a tumultuous time in the 60s and under the civil rights movement, such as other cities as Detroit and Memphis. And these were areas where music blended with social and political consciousness. Were there differences in how Chicago musicians acted as change agents compared with musicians in other cities?
That's a very interesting question. You know, in early drafts of my book, I did discuss that. I discussed how Chicagoans reacted differently to, for instance, the assassination of Dr. King than musicians in Memphis did, and different than musicians in Detroit did. But I cut all that out for the simple reason that much of my information about how Chicago musicians responded was by talking to these musicians, talking to people who were there, whether it was Jerry Butler or, Larry Wade, who was a partner of Terry Collier, or Willie Henderson. And they were all there. They all experienced the riots. They experienced the aftermath. They experienced the attempts to rebuild. Whereas in Memphis and Detroit, all of the information I was getting was through secondary sources, magazines, books, newspapers. You know, I would have had to go to Detroit and interview dozens and dozens of Detroit musicians. I would have had to go to Memphis and interview dozens and dozens of Memphis musicians to make a fair comparison, because I'm comparing primary sources in Chicago to secondary sources in Detroit and Memphis and other cities, whether it's Philadelphia or whatever. It didn't seem like a good comparison. So I felt, okay, well, I'm going to stick to Chicago because these are my primary sources. Now, I would have loved to spend time in Detroit and Memphis and other cities and talk to as many musicians as I could, but that was just not practical, given the fact that the book had to get finished. So I really didn't make that comparison. But one thing about Chicago that did stand out is from the musicians I spoke to, and again, I'm not going to compare it to the other cities because I didn't speak to so many musicians from other cities, but the attitude that I got, from speaking to Jerry Butler and, Larry Wade, the songwriter, and, Willie Henderson, so many others, Willie Henderson, an arranger and horn player, was the idea that they wanted to work. They wanted to get back to work. They felt then they would work, doing their jobs. And I think that was an attitude of, let's get back to work here. Let's create. Let's continue creating. Now, again, if that was different than Detroit or Memphis, since I didn't speak to musicians, I can't make that comparison.
So as these musicians in Chicago were establishing their own musical independence and their own identity, you talk about how Black representation and influence were establishing themselves in other cultural institutions. We're talking film, television, advertising. Share with us how music influenced and was influenced by those other arenas.
Well, that's the thing. I think advertising was a really big deal because Chicago had always been a big advertising center. And Chicago was dominated and still is actually by very large white corporations, large white advertising firms. And, I spoke to a few African-American advertisers who were, just wanting to get started in the business in the late 1960s. A few doors, not as many doors, but a few doors were opening up to Black advertisers, but they had to really push the doors open themselves. And like Burrell and, Barbara Gardner / Barbara Proctor. And, they wanted to also stand out, and they wanted to stand out from the bigger white companies. And one thing that they had that the white companies, larger white companies, did not have was music. and they had soul musicians who were quite happy to do jingles and commercials and TV shows, TV commercials. And that made these advertisers successful, and it helped them, you know, generate. And for the musicians themselves, it was great because they got paid much more money than they would have gotten if they were sitting around waiting for royalty checks to come in, you know, from record companies for all the reasons that you can imagine. So for them, it was a bonus. And it also helped spread this music, this sound, in other arenas besides records or the radio or actual performances. Of course, there was the Soul Train TV show, which started here in Chicago. And, you know, the Soul Train has been written about in other places as well. But, you know, I really felt that it was so crucial that it really needed to be a part of this whole story. And Soul Train also had a political agenda at first, and it was very much initially, you know, tied in with activism, political activists and stuff. Now, unfortunately, those early Chicago episodes are nowhere, you know, to be found, but that I've found. Hopefully they'll turn up someday. And but yeah, that was another way, was through the Soul Train TV show. Film soundtracks, you know, became very big in the 1970s. Curtis Mayfield being, you know, a big, you know, contributor to the whole, you know, soul soundtrack market. But also too, there were some lesser known films as well that I felt needed to be emphasized. And the film Stony Island from the late 1970s, which presented an endearing, if idealized, view of African-American and white musicians working together. But it's such a charming film that really should be seen.
So you mentioned film, you mentioned television and advertising. What's the role of radio during this time? I'm thinking, you know, such WVON as the obvious one. So talk about the role radio played during this time.
Well, WVON was certainly crucial. I mean, it was crucial in terms of not just providing an outlet for, soul music from everywhere. It wasn't just a soul, Chicago soul only station, obviously, WVON, which was owned by the Chess Record Company. But there was also WGRT as well. That was important for a few reasons, and not just for playing music, not just for providing a way to get this music out into the world, but also helping establish a sense of cultural identity among African-American youth in Chicago in the 1960s and into the 1970s, and the idea of gathering and how they could make statements through even their clothing and forming a sense of identity. I think in mainstream media in Chicago, and by this I mean the big AM station WLS, and, you know, local TV shows, and in the larger newspapers like the Chicago Tribune, that to the larger community of media in Chicago, you know, the African-American youth were invisible. And WVON gave this community visibility. And it could have not just been just from playing records, but also through, you know, through having record hops, dance hops. And I talked to young people some of whom became musicians, who were very much part of that scene and what that scene was all about in terms of establishing identity, establishing a group identity, as well as individual identities. So, you know, these were very important. And it's funny too, because you ask me about what people have said, and Richard Steele, who's still very much a part of media in Chicago, told me that even though there was rivalry, there was also cooperation among different people in African-American media and in record labels here in Chicago, which is interesting too. So there were definitely many different ways in which media was important. Then there was also the endurance of the Chicago Defender and Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine. So there was print media too, also continued to play a very big part in all of this. And one of the things too, I think I should mention this as like advice to future researchers, is that for anybody who has a Chicago Public Library card, the entire archives of the Chicago Defender, which is an incredible institution going back more than 100 years, is available online, easily searchable. So, you know, so much of this access is free to researchers that definitely does need to be taken advantage of.
Yeah, huge library advocate here. Like, completely understand the importance of libraries, and that leads me to think about the thing about this book is there's a lot of information, and you craft a very cohesive narrative throughout. But I want to get a sense of what were some of your biggest challenges when you were writing the book.
Well, one of the challenges, and this is a very sad one, is so many people have passed on, and getting in touch with people. But I knew that going in, that there were a lot of people who were just not going to be available. I was just very heartbroken that there were some people who I wanted to speak to who passed on before I could. There were, I think, about 12 people who I interviewed for the book who died before the book was published. So whatever I went through, I mean, the most emotionally draining was that aspect, was losing people. And I still have difficulty, of course, with that. But then in terms of crafting the book was taking the different sources, whether it's the interviews I did, I just mentioned the library research, academic research too, because I was drawing on such disciplines also, along with music, as, sociology and history and political science. But, it couldn't be too much of that because it was still essentially a music book. But I felt it was important how to weave musical analysis in with my whole thesis and make sure that it all fit together as a narrative. And I have to give, a million degrees of thanks and credit to my editor, Elizabeth Branch Dyson, who, was the best possible editor I could have to navigate through that and to come up with how to balance all of this. And it's funny, though, because one of the things that Elizabeth and I went back and forth on quite a bit was fine-tuning my introduction and, really honing it in and coming up with an introduction. And it was only after the book was published for about 8 months or so after it was published, thought of a great idea I should have done for the introduction instead. So that was one challenge. But having a great editor, really. And then also knowing when to end, knowing when to stop, knowing when to, I just mentioned the pain of not being able to speak to as many people as I wanted to. But, there was a time when I had to just get to writing it and sit down and do so. And, that was something that, just to focus on the writing part as opposed to the, research interviews and listening to music time and time again. And because if I'm listening to one song, I can't write about a different song because that's too distracting. So just all of that. None of this was frustrating, though. I mean, this was all part of the process that I expected.
Was there anything that surprised you about writing the book?
There was a number of things that surprised me. I didn't realize at first how huge advertising was. And it's something that really came about as I was working, was what, how important it was for the musicians to have, those advertising jobs and that role. I had an idea as to how many records and singles were released at this time, but it's a lot more than I thought initially. Just the sheer number. And not only that, but how amazing they were and how diverse they were. And, I knew that there was a lot of great, interesting, diverse music, but as I kept working on it, I kept discovering more and more and more. That was interesting. And also too, I mentioned earlier that when I talked to the songwriter, Reynard Miner, and his views of growing up on the West Side and going to high school were different than historians had said. And for many people, their own experiences were different and unique. And so people would tell me about their unique experiences, and they were different than somebody else's, and they were different than a lot of historians and commentators had stated. So, everybody I spoke to in telling me their life story yielded surprise.
And that's always an important thing, too, when you're covering a narrative that is focused on a marginalized group of people and whose history can be essentially erased. And that's there's a lot of weight and responsibility for that. And the fact that you talked to over 100 people about this and really did your due diligence and went through this process is amazing to me. And it makes me think about the world we're in now and that level of responsibility. Since your book was published in 2019, a lot has happened in the world that has shaped public consciousness and dialogues on how we approach our collective understanding on race and representation and appropriation. And I wanted to get a sense of that as a white man who authored this book with Black social issues at the heart of its narrative, how have you navigated this cultural landscape as an expert historian of soul and R&B and the challenges that come with that?
One of the main challenges is to be a listener and to listen to the people who are telling me their stories. And, I think another challenge along with, being a different race than most, but not all of the people I interviewed, is also I'm just from a different generation. I'm from a different time period. And that all shaped a different perspective. I can only be who I am, and I have to be honest about, who I am. I'm not going to pretend to know what they know. I'm not going to pretend because that's what their voices are there for, is to let me know and let the readers know what they know. I don't feel that there's any other way to do it but than to let people speak. Now we talk about the world we live in now, and I think the same is true today, and that is it's important for anybody who wants to write about people's stories is to put the focus on listening, put the focus on listening to people talk about their lives, talk about what's important to them and what always was important to them. And I think that's really what it comes down to. And again, it could be about African-American issues. It could be about the situation in the Ukraine. I feel that, it's important to speak to people and let them give their perspectives as to what's going on. And so I think that's really all I can say about that is just let them tell their stories and provide. And also, too, but of course, as we mentioned at the top of this, is to, look for corroboration when it's there as well. I mean, as much as as in awe as I was and am of all the people I spoke to, yes, there was still a process of fact-checking and looking at things and corroborating and make sure that there's no personal axes to grind. But another thing, too, is to also just come into it knowing that there's going to be a diversity of opinions, that people will not agree with each other. People will not agree with the historical narrative. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. But not to discount any of it. I think that's the most important thing, is just not to discount. It's like some of the people, when I would show them parts of the book, they would, say, well, this person seems to be a bit different, let's just say. And I'm like, yeah, but that voice needs to be there. And so I think that's important. That's crucial.
As we discussed earlier, your narrative in the book covers from the late 50s to the early 80s. And while you don't go as in depth to the later decades, you do kind of touch upon those. The book ends with you briefly exploring various ways soul and R&B continues to influence new generations of music makers and listeners. And you cite examples such as hip hop sampling, Afrofuturist aesthetic and philosophy, and even the social responsibility of reissue labels to properly tell narratives. And one of the things that really struck me about the end of the book is you discuss a rapper named Shay Smith who performs by the name of Rhymefest. Yeah. And how he blends.
Rhymefest, yeah. So as soon as he says his name, like, yeah, Rhymefest, yeah.
And what Rhymefest does is he blends art with civic engagement and that. And to quote, the ties between music, economics, and a shared culture form a holistic sensibility. And I want to get your thoughts on the evolution of Black cultural and social power through music over the last several decades and what the parallels and differences regarding the intersection of politics in music and business have with that period you cover and Move On Up.
Well, I think that there's a lot of different ways. I want to go back, you know, you mentioned popular music, hip hop and stuff. And I want to talk about jazz as well. Here in Chicago, there's people like Mike Reed, a wonderful jazz drummer, wonderful jazz musician, who was also an entrepreneur and runs Constellation, Hungry Brain. He, you know, runs the Pitchfork Festival as a volunteer. He runs the programming committee of the Chicago Jazz Festival. He really takes his responsibilities as a musician, as an entrepreneur, as a citizen very, very seriously. And, you know, it's a funny thing because the reason why he lives in Chicago is because his father from Louisiana saw the Impressions and felt that, wow, if, you know, people in Chicago, if African-Americans in Chicago can look this sharp and be this sharp, I want to move to Chicago. So, you know, he moved to Chicago. Now his son is a great musician, great entrepreneur, great presence here in Chicago. Rhymefest, who you just mentioned, you know, a rapper who he ran for alderman, and he's also engaged in other philanthropic efforts. There is that idea of also educating too. You know, a lot of musicians who are educators as well as activists, and you know, that's certainly, and entrepreneurs, and that's certainly very important. So I think then and now, it's not just the political role of, you know, running for office as Rhymefest does. It's, you know, not just in conscious raising lyrics, as many people do who are in hip hop or R&B or, you know, or rock as well, but also, you know, running businesses, small scale, large scale, and also just being, you know, present and, you know, creating just great music can be liberating and empowering in and of itself. And I mentioned the young woman, Raven Lene, who I don't believe lives in Chicago at the moment, but she did when I wrote the book. And, you know, someone who brings in, you know, a fresh spirit, and especially, you know, regarding her addressing African-American women. And then there were people like Jamila Woods, who also, you know, creates from a poetic spirit and brings that, you know, sense of history to her poetic delivery. And so there are, you know, so many examples, but also too, you know, there are just musicians who are just great at what they do. And I think that in and of itself is, you know, makes an incredible statement. So like in the 60s, like in the 70s, like today, there are, you know, many great examples and many diverse examples. You know, many bad examples too, but why talk about them?
So you're an expert in this area, and of course, because you wrote the book covering this period, and you are able to highlight, you know, things several decades later. Where do you see things going from here? What's the next couple decades look like for the influence of soul and R&B and what they represent?
Well, I think it's fantastic the way so many younger generation musicians, whether they're in hip hop, your audiences, you know, are responding to the music. And again, I mentioned samples is just one way, but I think the general overall sound as well. One interesting phenomenon, which I didn't really go into too much depth in the book, but I kind of gave a little hint of it, is a lot of music from this period, especially soul music from Chicago, has become very popular in Latino communities in East LA and in Mexico and other countries. And that's a phenomenon that I'd like to spend more time thinking about and exploring and looking into. So, you know, it's I mean, the love of this music is really strong in these communities. So that's another phenomenon that I really do need to explore in greater depth. Maybe that's a future book or a future scholarly article. But I think, you know, I think the message, I just I think that younger musicians are always going to be, you know, not just, you know, as they say, crate digging, record collecting, but, you know, exploring instruments, playing music. I mean, they're just, again, to give a jazz as an example, there are so many great young jazz musicians playing. It's only natural that they'll be intersecting with R&B and soul musicians who are younger as well. And there'll be future collaborative efforts across genre lines, across stylistic lines. You know, there'll be, you know, spoken word artists and rappers who will continue to bring consciousness to their lyrics, consciousness to their, you know, delivery. It's funny, I keep showing my age because a lot of the hip hop examples I think of are, well, they're younger than me, but they're still not young per se. But, people like Kendrick Lamar, I guess, would be one example. He's not from Chicago, but, actually, I mentioned Chance the Rapper in the epilogue, and I guess he's still young, isn't he? He's younger than me. I can say that. So, we people like him, people who continue to No Name, another rapper who, again, music is different, but I think the belief system, what goes on around it, how the connection between performer and audience, things are never going to be the same as they once were, but one can find echoes, reverberations, similarities as well. The only thing that I wish is that more musicians from the 60s and 70s would be alive to see and hear that appreciation. We just lost a few months ago the great Syl Johnson. And, fortunately, Syl lived long enough to, see his music being sampled and to benefit from it as well. Of course, he had to continue to fight to get his payments, and I'm glad he did. So, I just hope more musicians are able to see and hear and reap the benefits of this attention.
So you mentioned several times about musicians who have passed over the last couple of decades, and I'm thinking about the earliest interview you credit in the book, and it was with Terry Collier, and it was conducted in 1997, long before you began thinking about this book. And you say in the book he caused many people to think deeply, and I want to get a sense of what was his impact on you to think more deeply.
Well, I interviewed Terry Collier. That was for a Downbeat article, and that was when Terry Collier, to give a little backdrop, he sang folk music in the 1960s. And then in the latter 1960s, he recorded his own albums, which were a combination of folk and jazz and soul. And the great Charles Stepney produced him. And Terry Collier wrote a lot of great songs with Larry Wade for his own records. And also they wrote songs for groups like the Dells. The Love We Had Stays on My Mind. And then he recorded in the 1970s, but then Terry quit music because he was a single father and made the decision, I'm going to be a single dad and get a job to stay at home and raise my daughter. And he did that very successfully. And then in the late 90s, he started recording again. And that was the occasion in which I interviewed him for Downbeat. And his lyrics are very deep, very moving, very spiritual. His music stood out as well because of this combination of different things, whether it's jazz or soul or folk, and really expanded that whole idea of what is soul music. Well, it is Terry Collier as much as it is the Dells. And people might hear a vocal group harmony like the Dells and say, okay, well, that's soul, but Terry's doing his own thing. But, with Terry, it showed how expansive this music is. He set the path for people who came later, like Prince, he also just as a very, just a very deep, moving, spiritual figure as well. And not only was his music so expansive that could include so many different things, but it was also done from a place of great love and spirituality in the best sense of the word. And, the songs he sang, the lyrics about, what color is love being, really just a wonderful example of that. And, and that was who he was as a person too, in the times I spent with him, not just in the interview I did with him, but also just, spending a little time with him. And he also in the last few years of his life just was very focused on, family. So, he thought made people more think deeply about what music could be, what this music could be, what one's experiences could be, because he also, as I mentioned, came out of the Cabrini Green neighborhood along with Jerry Butler and Curtis Mayfield and them. But, his music had a different path, but it was a path of his own. And he was a real leader as well in terms of saying that things can be different. We can take from these different traditions. And so it was just, he also showed me too that, hey, there's a whole lot of different things going on with the Chicago musical history I hadn't thought about. So at the time that I interviewed Terry Collier in 1997 was also when I was writing about the Pharaohs, who were a group that came out of the Afro Arts Theater, who their records were being reissued at that time. And long story short, the Pharaohs, some of them spun off into Earth, Wind, and Fire, but that's getting ahead of the story. But I started to think, okay, a lot of these people like Terry Collier, like the Pharaohs, their music is not being written about as much as it should. And also their music is very different from each other, but they were from the same city at the same time. So what is going on here in Chicago at this time? Because there's something going on. And of course, also I always loved Curtis Mayfield. Curtis Mayfield's music always meant a lot to me. And he's very prominent in Robert Pruder's book. But I thought, okay, how does Curtis Mayfield, and what did he do? How does that fit into this whole context of what Terry Collier was doing, with what the Pharaohs were doing, with all these other people in the city were doing, and what was going on in the city? So I think it's a very long and disjointed answer to your question, but yeah.
No, it's great. I love it. All your answers have been just fantastic. Just hearing this. What have you learned since Move On Up was published?
Well, one of the things that I learned, and again, I mentioned the influence of Chicago soul music on contemporary Latino culture, which I'm still learning about. I'm still, trying to think of a way that could be something. There were a couple of people in the book who I felt should have their own books, and I'm working actually with one of them right now on that. So I probably shouldn't say more because that's still a project that's still in the works. I certainly learned a lot more about certain individuals than I had previously known.
So soul and R&B music is such an important passion for you, jazz as well. I mean, I follow you on social media. I see all the cool things you're doing. It's really amazing. And I want to know, what do you want people who may not be as familiar with soul and R&B to understand and take away from the experience of listening to that music?
I think one of the things that's important is to realize how diverse it is. People understand, okay, well, there's swing, and that's very different than bebop, which is very different than what might be considered avant-garde jazz, and that's different than, electronic jazz fusion. And, which is great. I mean, I love so many different aspects of jazz. I'm certainly not, prejudiced about any one. And I think soul music should also be treated as a diverse form of music with many different strains. And, one of the things that's fascinated so much me with that resonated so much with me about soul music in Chicago is that a lot of these different strains were wonderful and great here in Chicago, flourished here in Chicago. So when one listens to soul music, listen to how diverse it is. And also too, singers obviously are important, but also listen to arrangers, producers, instrumentalists. With each great soul record, there's so many people as a part of it that, as wonderful as these singers are, and I could just list every one of my favorite soul singers, they also had wonderful drummers, wonderful bassists. Listen to the bass line as well. Listen to how all of this worked together, because there is so much incredible, oftentimes very, diverse, very intricate musical interplay going on with a great soul record, just as there is with a great jazz record. And, there might not be as much improvisation, but there probably will be some. So just consider all these things going on, that it's never just a simple 2.5 minute tune. There's more to it than that.
So one of the things you include in your book is a selected discography. And you mentioned a lot of music, but someone actually created a Spotify playlist of every song you mentioned in the book. And it's something like 12, 13 hours long. It's a lot of music. I've been listening to it. One of my highlights for me was The Dells, The Love You Had Stayed on My Mind, which you mentioned earlier. I had never heard that before. It opened doors for me. I want to know, what are some of your favorite songs you covered in the book?
The title track, Move On Up, certainly. And I have to say, though, that every time I'm asked for my favorites, it changes. There's so many great ones. And, you know, you asked me also what I learned since writing the book. And, you know, there was a whole bunch of singles I found that I didn't include because I didn't know about them. There's thousands of them. So Move On Up, the title track, Is It Because I'm Black, late Syl Johnson's. The Dells, Love We Have, Stays On My Mind. You know, I mentioned Terry Collier's What Color Is Love. You know, Jackie Ross, Selfish One, you know, Mitty Collier as well. You know, I Had to Talk With My Man. You know, there's so many. Oh, Lost Generation, The Slide, Slick, The Wicked. You know, The Shy Lights, For God's Sake, Give More Power to the People. Barbara Ackland, you know, so many of her songs. You know, I Did It, Barbara Ackland. You know, I just keep going and going. So once you get me going about favorites, you know, go on forever. Duke of Earl, Gene Chandler, Duke of Earl, you know, Major Lance, Rhythm, you know, so many.
And we'll save all those new singles you discovered for the expanded edition, should it come down the road. I hope so.
Absolutely. So. And you know, that's one of the things that I would like more opportunities to DJ, is just to play records for people. I love, you know, sharing music with people. It's just so great, you know.
It's a lot of fun. And as just a fun question to end with, who would you have liked to have interviewed for this book but couldn't, living or dead?
Oh, living or dead. Well, Curtis Mayfield.
I thought so. he graces the cover of your book. And he's such a central Mayfield. Figure as well.
Yeah. I mean, and it was, I mean, yeah, so that was without question.
Well, excellent. Aaron, this has been a great conversation and I had a lot of fun. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was great to be here. Great to be a part of this.
Absolutely. And this was a wonderful interview for me because I read your book during that first summer COVID in 2020. And I've been in Chicago for 11 years now. And, you know, as every Chicagoan, you have ups and downs with the city. And reading your book made me fall in love with Chicago again. And I know that even if it wasn't during a very difficult time, I still would have had that connection with your book. That's how much I love this book.
Well, thank you very much. That means a lot to me because that's what the book is all about. So thank you very much for saying that. Very kind of you.
My name is Bradley Morgan, and you've been listening to New Books in Music with my guest today, Aaron Cohen. His book is Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power, and is published by the University of Chicago Press.